door. "Don't trust them," Julian called after him. "Don't." He shook his head as the door closed. "Guess he'll have to learn on his own." "That reminds me," Emma said, leaning on the counter. "We have an emergency situation."
"An emergency?"
With a concerned look, he thumbed off the water and turned to face her. Emma set her bottle drink down. Soap suds were clinging to Jules' forearms, and his T-shirt was damp from the hot water. She couldn't help a flash of memory. Jules in the back of the car, looking up at her with gritted teeth. The way his skin had felt under her hands, the slipperiness of his blood. "Is it Diana?" he said, reaching for paper towels.
"What?"
That snapped her out of her reverie. "Is Diana all right?"
"Presumably," he said.
"She left a note saying she was going to be gone today. Back to Ojai to see her warlock friend."
"She doesn't know about tonight," Emma leaned on the counter. "Does she?"
Jules shook his head, a damp curl stuck to his cheekbone.
"Didn't exactly get a chance to tell her."
"You could text," Emma pointed out, "or call."
"I could," he said neutrally, "but then I'd feel like I needed to tell her about me getting hurt last night."
"Maybe you should."
"I'm fine," he said. "I mean, really, fine. Like nothing ever happened." He shook his head.
"I don't want her insisting I stay back from tonight. The theater could be nothing, but if it's something, I want to be there."
He dropped the paper towels in the trash.
"If you're there, I want to be there."
"I like it when you're deceptive." Emma stretched up on her toes, arms behind her head, trying to work out the kinks in her back muscles. Cool air touched the bare skin of her stomach as her tank pulled up.
"If you're totally fine, though, maybe you don't ever have to tell Diana.
Just a suggestion."
When Julian didn't answer, she glanced up at him. He was arrested mid-motion, looking at her. Each of his lashes was a perfect dark line. He was expressionless. His gaze shuddered, as if caught in a peculiar stillness. He was beautiful, the most beautiful thing she'd ever seen. She wanted to crawl inside his skin, live where he breathed. She wanted. She was terrified. She had never wanted like this around Julian before. It was because he'd almost died, she told herself. Her whole system was wired to monitor his survival. She needed him to live. He'd nearly died, and everything inside her was short-circuiting. He would be horrified, she told herself. If he knew how she was feeling, he'd be disgusted. Things would go back to the way they were when he'd first come back from England, when she thought that he was angry at her. That maybe he hated her. "He knew even then," said a small voice at the back of her mind. "He knew about your feelings. He knew what you didn't know." She pressed her hands hard against the counter, the marble digging into her palms, the pain clearing her head.
"Shut up," she told the voice in her head. "Shut up."
"An emergency." His voice was low.
"You said there was an emergency?"
"A fashion emergency. Christina needs a dress to blend in tonight, and there's literally nothing in the house." She glanced at her watch. "It should take us 30 minutes, tops."
He relaxed, clearly relieved.
"Hidden treasures?" he asked.
It was a good guess. Emma's favorite vintage store was well known to the family. Every time she went, she picked things up for them. A bow tie for Tavi, a flowered headband for Livy, an old horror movie poster for Drew.
"Yep. Do you want anything?"
"I've always kind of wanted a Batman clock that says, 'Wake up, boy wonder,' when it goes off," he said. "It would liven up my room."
"We've got it," Livy said, bounding into the kitchen. "Well, some of it anyway, but it's weird."
Emma turned to her with relief.
"Got what?"
"In English, Livy," said Julian. "What's weird?"
"We translated some of the lines in the cave," said Ty, trailing in on Livy's heels. He was wearing an oversized gray hooded sweater that swallowed up his hands. His dark hair spilled over the edge of the hood. "But they don't make sense."
"Are they a message?" Emma said.
Livy shook her head.
"Lines from a poem," she said, unfolding the paper she held.
"But our love, it was stronger by far than the love of those who were older than we, of many far wiser than we, and neither the angels in heaven above nor the demons down under the sea can ever dissever my soul from the soul of the beautiful Annabel Lee."
"Annabel Lee," said Julian. "Edgar Allan Poe."
"I know the poem," Livy said, scrunching up her eyebrows. "I just don't know why it was written on the walls of the cave."
"I thought maybe it was a book cipher," said Ty. "But that would mean there was a second half of it. Something in another location, maybe. Might be worth checking with Malcolm."
"I'll add it to the list," said Julian.
Christina stuck her head in through the kitchen door.
"Emma," she said, "are you ready to go?"
"You look worried," said Livy. Is Emma taking you somewhere to kill you?
Worse, Emma said, heading over to join Christina at the door.
Shopping.
For tonight?
First, I am so jealous, and second, don't let her take you to that place in Topanga Canyon. That's enough, Emma clapped her hands over Christina's ears.
Don't listen to her. She's lost her mind from all the code-breaking.
Pick me up some cufflinks, Jules called, heading back toward the sink.
What color? Emma paused halfway out of the door with Christina.
I don't care, as long as they hold my cuffs together.
Otherwise they'll be sad and unlinked, Jules said.
And get back as quick as you can.
The sound of the water running in the sink was drowned out by Livy, who had already begun reciting more of the poem. It was many and many a year ago in a kingdom by the sea.
This is where you want to buy clothes? Christina asked, her eyebrows arched, as Emma pulled the Toyota into a dirt parking lot surrounded by trees.
It's the closest place, Emma said, turning off the car.
In front of them was a single freestanding building with a sign boasting foot-high letters and glitter that spelled out the words, Hidden Treasures. A massive red and white popcorn machine stood next to the store, along with a painted model of a curtained caravan advertising the services of Gargantua the Great.
And besides, it's awesome.
This does not look like a place you buy glamorous dresses, Christina said, wrinkling up her nose. This looks like a place where you are kidnapped and sold to the circus.
Emma grabbed her by the wheel.
Don't you trust me? She wheedled.
Of course not, Christina said. You're crazy.
But she let Emma drag her into the store, which was filled with kitschy knick-knacks. Fiesta ware platters, old china dolls, and up by the register, racks of vintage jewelry and watches. A second room opened off the first. It was full of clothes, amazing clothes. Second-hand vintage Levi's, 50s pencil skirts in tweed and bombazine, and tops in silk and lace and crushed velvet. And in a smaller second room off the main one, the dresses. They looked like hanging butterflies, sheets of red organza, watercolor-printed charmeuse, the hem of a baldman gown, the froth of a tulle petticoat, like foam on water.
Didn't Julian say he needed cufflinks? Christina said, pulling Emma to a stop by the counter.
The salesgirl behind it, wearing a pair of cat's-eye glasses and a name tag that said Sarah, studiously ignored them. Emma ran her eyes over the display of men's cufflinks. Most were joke items, shaped like dice or guns or cats, but there was a section of nicer ones, consignment Paul Smith and Burberry and Lanvin. As she ran her gaze over them, she felt suddenly shy. Picking out cufflinks seemed like something a girlfriend would do. Not that she'd ever done it for Cameron, or anyone else she dated even briefly, but she'd never cared enough to want to. When Julian had a girlfriend, Emma knew, she would absolutely be the sort of girl who would pick out cufflinks for him, who would remember his birthday and call him every day. She would adore him. How could she not? Emma picked up a pair of gold-plated cufflinks with black stones set in them, almost blindly. The thought of Julian with a girlfriend sent a pain through her that she couldn't comprehend. Setting the cufflinks down on the counter, she walked into the small room full of dresses. Christina followed her, looking worried.
I used to come here with my mom, Emma thought, running the back of her hand across the rack of satins and silks and bright rayons. She loved crazy vintage things, old Chanel jackets, beaded flapper dresses. But out loud, all she said was, "We have to hurry. We shouldn't be spending so much time away from the Institute while the investigation's happening."
Christina grabbed up a shimmering cocktail dress in pink brocade, sprinkled with tiny gold flowers.
I'm going to try this on.
She disappeared into a changing booth with a curtain made from a Star Wars bedsheet. Emma pulled another dress from the rack, pale silk with beaded silver straps. Looking at it made her feel the way she did when she looked at a gorgeous sunset or one of Julian's paintings, or his hands moving over the brushes and bottles of paint. She went into the dressing room to change. When she came out, Christina was standing in the middle of the room, scowling down at her pink dress. It clung like saran wrap to her every curve.
"I think it's too tight," she said.
"I think it's supposed to be that tight," said Emma. "It makes your boobs look great."
"Emma!"
Christina looked up, scandalized, then gasped.
"Oh, you look so lovely."
Emma touched the ivory and silver material of the dress with uncertain hands. White meant death and mourning to shadow hunters. They rarely wore it casually, though the fact that it was ivory meant she could get away with it.
"You think?"
Christina was smiling at her.
"You know, sometimes you are just like I thought you would be, and sometimes you are so different."
Emma moved to look in the mirror.
"What do you mean? what you thought I would be like. Christina picked up a snow globe and frowned at it.
You know, it wasn't just Mark I heard about before I came here. I heard about you. Everyone said you would be the next Jace Herondale, the next great shadow hunter warrior.
I'm not going to be that, said Emma.
Her own voice sounded calm and small and distant in her ears. She couldn't believe she was saying what she was saying. The words seemed to be coming out without her thoughts forming them first, as if they were creating their own reality by being spoken.
I'm not special, Christina. I don't have extra angel blood or special powers. I'm an ordinary shadow hunter.
You are not ordinary.
I am. I don't have magic powers. I'm not cursed or blessed. I can do exactly what everyone else can do. The only reason I'm good is because I train.
Salesgirl Sarah stuck her head back around the door, her eyes saucer-wide. Emma had forgotten she was there.
Do you need any help?
I need so much help, you have no idea, Emma said.
Alarmed, Sarah retreated to her counter.
This is embarrassing, Christina said in a whispered hiss. She probably thinks we're lunatics. We should go.
Emma sighed. I'm sorry, Tina, she said. I'll pay for everything.
But I don't even know if I want this dress, Christina called as Emma vanished back into the changing cubicle.
Emma whirled around and pointed at her. Yes, you do. I was serious about your boobs. They look amazing. I don't even think I've ever seen that much of your boobs before. If I had boobs like that, you better believe I'd show them off.
Please stop saying boobs, Christina wailed. It's a terrible word. It sounds ridiculous.
Maybe, said Emma, yanking the dressing room door shut. But they look great. 10 minutes later, dresses and shopping bags, they were driving back down the canyon road toward the ocean. Christina, in the seat next to Emma, sat with her legs crossed demurely at the ankles, not propped up on the dashboard like Emma's would have been. All around them, the familiar scenery of the canyon rose up. Gray rock, green scrub, and chaparral. Oak trees and Queen Anne's lace. Once, Emma had climbed up into these mountains with Jules and found an eagle's nest, a tiny cache of the bones of mice and bats inside it.
You are wrong about why you are good at what you do, Christina said. It is not just training. Everyone trains, Emma.
Yeah, but I kill myself training, Emma said. It's just about all I do. I get up and train and run. And I split my hands on the punching bag, and I train for hours into the night. And I have to, because there's nothing else special about me and nothing else that matters. All there is training and finding out who killed my parents. Because they were the ones who thought I was special, and whoever took them away from me.
Other people think you're special, Emma, said Christina, sounding more like an older sister than ever.
What I have is trying, said Emma, her voice tinged with bitterness. She was thinking of the tiny bones in the nest, how fragile they'd been, how easily snapped between a pair of fingers. I can try harder than anyone else in the world. I can make revenge the only thing I have in my life. I can do that, because I have to, but it means it's all I have.
It's not all you have, Christina said. What you haven't had is your moment. Your chance to be great.
Jace Herondale and Clary Fairchild weren't heroes in a vacuum. There was a war. They were forced to make choices.
Those moments come for all of us. They will come for you, too.
She laced her fingers together. The angel has a plan for you. I promise it.
You're more prepared than you think. You have stayed strong not just through training, but through the people around you, loving them and being loved. Julian and the others, they have not let you isolate yourself. Alone with your revenge and your bitter thoughts. The sea wears down cliffs, Emma, and turns them into sand. So love wears us down and breaks our defenses. You only do not know how much it means to have people who will fight for you when it goes wrong.
Her voice cracked and she looked toward the window. They had reached the highway. Emma almost drove into traffic in alarm.
Christina, what is it? What happened?
Christina shook her head.
I know something happened to you in Mexico, Emma said. I know someone hurt you. Just please tell me what it was and what they did. I promise I won't try to hunt them down and feed them to my imaginary fish. She sighed. I want to help.
You cannot. Christina glanced down at her interlaced fingers. Some betrayals cannot be forgiven. Was it perfect, Diego?
Let it go, Emma, Christina said.
And so Emma did. And the rest of the way back to the Institute, they talked about their dresses and how to best conceal weapons and items of clothing that were not meant to hide in the armory. But Emma had noticed the way Christina had flinched when she'd said Diego's name. Maybe not now, maybe not today, she thought, but she would find out what had happened.
Julian flew downstairs at the loud repetitive pounding on the front door of the Institute. He was still barefoot. He hadn't had a chance to put shoes on yet. Once he'd finished cleaning up after breakfast, he'd spent an hour trying to convince Uncle Arthur that no one had stolen his bust of Hermes. It was under his desk. Found out that Drusilla had locked herself in Tavi's playhouse in a sulk because she hadn't been invited to the diner the night before. Tavi discovered Ty had been hiding a skunk in his room and started screaming. Livy was busy convincing Ty to release the skunk back into the wild. Ty thought that the fact that he and Livy had translated the Poe lines meant that he'd earned the right to keep the skunk. Mark, the only sibling who hadn't given Julian any trouble that day, was hiding somewhere. Julian swung the door open. Malcolm Fade stood on the other side, wearing jeans and the kind of sweatshirt you could tell was expensive because it appeared to be filthy and torn, but artfully so. Someone had spent time and money ripping that sweatshirt. "You know, it's not a good idea to whack on the door like that," said Julian. "We keep a lot of weapons down here in case someone tries to break in."
"Huh," said Malcolm. "I'm not sure what that first statement has to do with the second statement."
"Don't you? I thought it was obvious." Malcolm's eyes were a brilliant purple, which usually meant he was in a peculiar mood.
"Aren't you going to let me in?"
"No," Julian said. His mind was whirling with thoughts of Mark. Mark was upstairs, and Malcolm couldn't see Mark. Mark's return was too much of a secret to ask him to keep, and too much of a clue as to the reason for their investigation. Julian schooled his features into a look of pleasant blandness, but didn't move from his place blocking the door. "Ty brought a skunk inside," he said. "Believe me, you don't want to come in." Malcolm looked alarmed.
"A skunk?"
"A skunk," Julian said. Julian believed that all the best lies were based on truth. "Did you translate any of the markings?"
"Not yet," Malcolm said. He moved his hand, not much, a small gesture, but the copies of the partially translated markings they'd given him appeared, held delicately between his fingers. Sometimes, Julian thought, it was easy to forget that Malcolm was a powerful user of magic.
"But I did discover their origins."
"Really?"
Julian tried to look shocked. They already knew the language was an ancient one of fairy, though they hadn't been able to tell Malcolm that. On the other hand, this was a chance to check and see if the fair folk had been telling them the truth. Julian eyed Malcolm with renewed interest.
"Wait, maybe this isn't the markings." Malcolm eyed the papers. "It seems to be a recipe for orange cake."
Julian crossed his arms over his chest.
"No, it isn't."
Malcolm frowned.
"I definitely remember looking at a recipe for orange cake recently."
Julian rolled his eyes silently. Sometimes with Malcolm you just had to be patient.
"Never mind," Malcolm said. "That was in a copy of O Magazine. This," he tapped the paper, "an ancient language of fairy. You were right. It predates Shadow Hunters. Anyway, that's the language origin. I can probably get more done in the next few days, but that's not why I came by."
Julian brightened.
"I did some examining of the poison on that fabric you sent me last night. I checked it against different toxins. It was a cataplasm. A concentrate of a rare type of the belladonna plant with demon poisons. It should have killed you."
"But Emma healed me," said Julian, "with an Arazi. So you're saying we should be looking for..."
"I wasn't saying anything about looking," Malcolm interrupted. "I'm just telling you. No Arazi should have been able to fix you. Even accounting for the strength of Parabatai runes, you absolutely shouldn't have survived."
His odd violet eyes fixed on Julian.
"I don't know if it's something you did or something Emma did, but whatever it was impossible. You shouldn't be breathing right now."
Julian trailed up the stairs slowly. He could hear yelling from above him, but not the sort that sounded as if anyone was in actual trouble. Telling the difference between play yelling and actual yelling was an absolute necessity when you were in charge of 4 kids. His mind was still on what Malcolm had told him, about the cataplasm. It was unnerving to be told that you should be dead. There was always the possibility that Malcolm was wrong, but somehow Julian doubted it. Hadn't Emma said something about finding belladonna plants near the convergence? Thoughts of poison and convergences vanished from his mind as he turned down the corridor from the stairs. The room they kept Tiberius's computer in was filled with light and noise. Julian moved into the doorway and stared. There was a video game alive and flickering on the computer screen. Mark was sitting in front of it, mashing rather desperately at the buttons on a controller as a truck sped toward him on screen. It crushed his character with a splat, and he tossed the controller aside.
"The box serves the Lord of Lies," he announced indignantly. Ty laughed,
and Julian felt something tug at his heart. The sound of his brother laughing was one of Julian's favorite noises, in part because Ty did it so sincerely, without any attempt to cover up his laughter or any sense he should hide it. Wordplay and irony often weren't funny to Ty, but people acting silly was, and he had an absolute and sincere amusement at the behavior of animals, Church falling off a table and trying to regain his dignity, that was beautiful to Julian. In the dead of night, lying in bed staring at his murals of thorns, Julian sometimes wished he could put down the role that required him to always be the one telling Ty he couldn't have skunks in his room, or reminding him it was time to study, or coming in to shut his lights off when he was reading instead of sleeping. What if, like a normal brother, he could watch Sherlock Holmes movies with Ty and help him collect lizards without worrying that they were going to escape and run through the Institute? What if... Julian's mother had always stressed the difference between doing something for someone and giving them the tools to do it themselves. It was how she had taught Julian to paint. Julian had always tried to do that for Ty, too, though it had often seemed like he was feeling his way in the dark. Making books, toys, lessons that seemed tailored to the special way Ty thought, was it the right thing to do? He thought it had helped. He hoped. Sometimes hope was all you had. Hope and watching Ty. There was a pleasure in seeing Ty become more himself, need help and guidance less and less. Yet there was a sadness, too, for the day his brother wouldn't need him anymore. Sometimes in the depths of his heart, Julian wondered if Ty would want to spend time with him at all, once that day had come, with a brother who was always making him do things and was no fun at all. "It's not a box," Ty said. "It's a controller." "Well, it lies," said Mark, turning around in his chair. He saw Julian leaning in the doorway and nodded. "Well met, Jules." Julian knew this was a fairy greeting and struggled internally not to point out to Mark that they'd already met this morning in the kitchen, not to mention several thousand times before that. He won over his baser impulses, but just barely. "Hi, Mark."
"Is everything all right?"
Julian nodded. "Could I talk to Ty for a second?" Tiberius stood up. His black hair was messy, getting too long. Julian reminded himself to schedule a haircut for both twins. Another thing to add to the calendar. Ty came out into the corridor, pulling the computer room door shut behind him. His expression was wary. "Is this about the skunk? Because Livy took it back outside." Julian shook his head. "It's not about the skunk." Ty lifted his face. He'd always had delicate features, more elfin than Helen or Marx. His father had said he was a throwback to earlier generations of Blackthorns, and he looked not unlike some of the family portraits in the dining room they rarely used, slender Victorian men in tailored clothes with porcelain faces and black curling hair. "Then what is it?" Julian hesitated. The whole house was still. He could hear the faint crackle of the computer on the other side of the door. He had thought about asking Ty to look into the poison that he had been shot with, but that would require him to say, "I was dying. I should be dead." The words wouldn't come. They were like a dam, and behind them were so many other words. "I'm not sure about anything. I hate being in charge. I hate making the decisions. I'm terrified you'll all learn to hate me. I'm terrified of losing you. I'm terrified of losing Mark. I'm terrified of losing Emma. I want someone to take over. I'm not as strong as you think. The things I want are wrong and broken things to want." He knew he could say none of this. The facade he showed them, his children, had to be perfect. A crack in him would be like a crack in the world to them. "You know I love you," he said instead, and Ty looked up at him, startled, meeting his gaze for a flicker of a moment. Over the years, Julian had come to understand why Ty didn't like looking into other people's eyes. It was too much movement, color, expression, like looking into a blaring television set. He could do it. He knew it was something people liked, and that it mattered to them. But he didn't see what the fuss was about. Ty was searching now, though, seeking in Julian's face the answer to his odd hesitancy. "I do know," Ty said finally. Julian couldn't help the ghost of a smile. It was what you wanted to hear, wasn't it, from your children, that they knew they were loved. He remembered when he had been carrying Tavi upstairs once, when he'd been 13, he'd tripped and fallen, twisting his body around so that he would land on his back and head, not caring if he was hurt as long as Tavi was all right. He'd cracked himself pretty hard in the head, too. But he'd sat upright fast, his mind racing. "Tavi, my baby, is he okay?" It was the first time he'd thought,
my baby and not the baby. I don't understand why you wanted to talk to me, though, Ty said, his dark brows drawn together in puzzlement. Was there a reason? Julian shook his head. In the distance, he could hear the front door open, the faint sound of Emma and Christina's laughter carrying. They were back. No reason at all, he said. 14. Bright Eyes. Standing in the marble entryway, Julian chanced one last look in the mirror. He had made Livy look up semi-formal for him, and had his grim suspicions confirmed. It meant a dark suit. The only one he had was a black Cy Devore vintage, one Emma had fished out of a bin at Hidden Treasures. It had a charcoal silk lining and mother-of-pearl buttons on the vest. When he'd put it on, she'd clapped her hands and told him he looked like a movie star, so of course he'd bought it.
You look very handsome, Andrew.
Julian spun around. It was Uncle Arthur. His stained gray robe was loosely belted around sagging jeans and a torn T-shirt. Gray stubble spiked along his jaw. Julian didn't bother to correct his uncle. He knew how much he looked like his father had when he was young. Maybe it comforted Arthur to imagine that his brother was still alive. Maybe seeing Julian in formal clothes reminded Arthur of years past, when he and his brother had been young and gone to parties and dances, before everything had fallen apart. Julian knew that Arthur grieved for his brother, in his own way. It was hidden under the layers of fairy enchantment and trauma that had shattered his mind. If it were not for the fact that Arthur was so retiring and so studious, Julian could only assume his condition would have been discovered before, when he lived at the London Institute. He also guessed that his uncle had gotten worse since the trauma of the Dark War. Still, sometimes when Arthur had taken the medicine Malcolm provided, Julian could catch glimpses of the shadow hunter he had been long ago, brave, sharp, and with a sense of honor like Achilles or Aeneas. "Hello, Arthur," he said. Arthur nodded decidedly. He placed his open palm against Julian's chest. "I have a meeting with Anselm Nightshade," he said in a deep voice.
"Good to know," Julian said.
It was good to know. Arthur and Anselm were friends, sharing a love of the classics. Anything that kept Arthur busy was an asset. Arthur turned with almost military precision and marched across the foyer and through the doors of the sanctuary. They clanged shut behind him. Laughter floated down into the entryway. Julian turned away from the mirror just in time to see Christina coming down the steps. Her brown skin glowed against the old-fashioned pink brocade of her dress. Gold chandelier earrings swung from her ears. After her came Emma. He registered her dress, but barely. That it was pale ivory, that it floated around her like angel wings. The hem brushed her ankles, and he could see the tips of white boots underneath. Knew there were knives tucked into the tops, their handles pressed against her calves. Her hair was loose, and it rippled down her back in dark gold waves. There was a movement, a softness to it that he knew he could never capture in paint. Gold leaf, maybe, if he painted like Klimt, but even then it would be a pale comparison to the real thing. She reached the bottom of the stairs and he realized that the material of her dress was just fine enough that he could see the shape and suggestion of her body through it. His pulse started a heartbeat against the inside of his cuffs. His suit felt too tight, his skin hot and scratchy. She smiled at him. Her brown eyes were outlined with gold. He picked up the lighter flecks in her irises, those circles of copper he had spent his childhood counting, memorizing. "I brought them," she said, and for a moment he forgot what she was talking about. Then he remembered and held out his wrists. Emma unfurled her fingers. Gold cufflinks set with black stones glimmered in her palm. Her touch was gentle as she took each of his hands in hers, turned it over, and carefully fastened the French cuffs of his shirt. She was quick, efficient, but he felt each glide and movement of her fingertips against the skin of his inner wrist like the touch of hot wires. She dropped his hands, stepped back, and pretended to survey him thoughtfully. "I guess you'll do," she said. Christina gave a gasp. She was looking up toward the top of the stairs. Julian followed her gaze. Mark was ascending the staircase. Julian blinked, not quite believing his eyes. His older brother seemed to be wearing a long, slightly ratty, fake fur coat. And nothing else. "Mark," he said, "what are you wearing?" Mark paused halfway down the stairs. His legs were bare.
His feet were bare. Julian was 99% sure all of him was bare except for the coat, which was fairly loose. It was more of Mark than Julian had seen since they'd shared a bedroom when he was 2. Mark looked puzzled.
Ty and Livy told me this was semi-formal.
It was then that Julian became aware of the pealing laughter from above. Ty and Livy were seated along the upstairs railing of the staircase, giggling.
"And I told you not to trust them." Emma's lips were twitching.
"Mark, just..." She held out a hand. Christina was standing and looking up at Mark with both her cheeks bright red, her hands clapped over her mouth.
"Go back up the landing, okay?"
She turned to Jules and dropped her voice.
"You have to find him something else to wear."
"You think?"
Emma raised her eyes in exasperation.
"Jules, go into my room, okay? Trunk at the foot of the bed, there's some of my parents' old clothes. My dad wore a tux at his wedding. There were rune bands around the cuffs, but we can rip those off."
"But your dad's tux..." She looked up at him sideways. "Don't worry about it." A dozen flecks of gold in her left eye. Only 7 in her right. Each one like a tiny starburst.
"I'll be right back," Julian said and jogged up the stairs toward his brother.
Mark was on the landing, his arms held out in front of him as if he were examining the sleeves of his fur coat and deciding that they, in fact, were the problem. Drew, holding Tavi's hand, had joined the twins. They were all giggling. The glow on Ty's face when he looked at Mark made Julian warm and cold all at once. What if Mark decided not to stay? What if they couldn't find the killer, and he was taken back to the Wild Hunt? What if...
"Would you say I'm overdressed or underdressed?" Mark inquired, arching his eyebrows.
Emma burst out laughing. She collapsed onto the bottom step of the staircase. A moment later, Christina had joined her. They clutched each other, helpless with laughter. Julian wanted to laugh, too. He wished he could. He wished he could forget the darkness that flickered at the edge of his vision. He wished he could close his eyes and fall, forgetting for one moment that there was no net stretched out below to catch him.
"Are you ready yet?" Julian asked the closed door of the bathroom. He'd retrieved John Carstairs' suit from Emma's trunk and dragged Mark back to his own bedroom to change. The thought of his brother being naked in Emma's room didn't sit well with him, even if Emma wasn't there. The door to the bathroom opened and Mark stepped out. The tux was black, simple. It was impossible to see where the ruined bands of fabric had been snipped away. The elegant lines of it seemed to sweep upward, making Mark appear taller, more polished. For the first time since his return, every bit of the feral fairy child in him appeared to have been brushed away like cobwebs. He looked human, like someone who'd always been human.
"Why do you bite your nails?" he said.
Julian, who hadn't even been conscious that he was gnawing on the side of his thumb, the satisfying pain of skin between his teeth, the metal of the blood in his mouth, dropped his hands into his lap.
"Bad habit."
"It's something people do when they're stressed," said Mark. "Even I know that."
His fingers scrabbled uselessly at his tie. He frowned down at it. Julian got to his feet and went over to his brother, taking the loops of the tie in his hands. He couldn't remember who had taught him how to knot a tie. Malcolm, he thought. It had almost certainly been Malcolm.
"But what do you have to be stressed about, little brother?" Mark said.
"You weren't carried away by the fairies. You've spent your life here. Not that the life of a shadow hunter isn't stressful, but why are you the one with the bloody hands?" Julian's fingers faltered for a moment. "You don't know everything about me, Mark. Just like I'm willing to bet I don't know everything about you." Mark's blue and gold eyes were wide and guileless.
"Ask me."
"I'd rather learn in my own time." Julian gave the tie a final tug and stepped back to examine his handiwork. Mark looked as if he might have stepped out of a catalog advertising tuxedos, if male catalog models had pointed ears.
"I wouldn't," said Mark. "Tell me one thing I don't know about you that makes you bite your fingers."
Julian turned toward the door, then paused, hand on the knob.
"Our father," he said.
"You know what happened to him?"
"He was turned into one of the Andarkened by Sebastian Morgenstern," said Mark. "How could I forget?"
"And then?"
"And then?" Mark sounded puzzled. "And then he died during the Dark War."
"Yes, he died," said Julian, "because I killed him." Mark drew in his breath. There was shock in that gasp, and pity. Julian tensed. He couldn't bear being pitied.
"He was coming for Ty," said Julian. I did what I had to do.
It wasn't him, Mark said swiftly.
That's what everyone says. Julian was still facing the door. He felt a light tap on his shoulder and turned to see Mark looking at him.
But everyone didn't see it happen, Julian, our father being turned.
I did, Mark said, and suddenly in his voice there was the sound of the older brother he had been, the one who knew more, had lived more.
The light in his eyes went out like a candle guttering in the dark. He was already dead inside. All you did was bury the body.
There was sadness in Mark's eyes, and knowledge, the knowledge of dark things. Mark had blood on his hands, too, Julian thought, and for a moment the idea was such a relief that he felt the weight on his shoulders lift incrementally.
Thank you for the assistance, Mark said formally,
with my manner of dress. I will not trust the twins again with important matters of human tradition.
Julian felt his lip twitch up at the corner.
Yeah, I wouldn't.
Mark looked down at himself.
I am presentable?
You look like James Bond.
Mark smiled, and Julian felt a small swell of absurd gladness rise up in his chest that his brother had gotten the reference, that he was pleased.
They made their way back toward the entryway in silence, the silence pierced as they reached the landing by the sound of someone shouting. Together they were brought up short at the top of the stairs.
Does your vision match mine, brother? Mark asked.
If you mean am I seeing what you're seeing, Julian hazarded. Then yes, if you mean that the foyer is full of chihuahuas.
It's not just chihuahuas, said Ty, who was sitting on the top step, enjoying the spectacle. It's a number of different small dogs of various breeds.
Julian snorted. The foyer was indeed full of small dogs. They yipped and barked and surged.
Don't worry about the dogs, he said. Nightshade likes to stash them in the entryway when he meets with Uncle Arthur.
Nightshade? Mark's eyebrows went up. Ansel Nightshade? The head of the Los Angeles vampire clan?
Yep, Julian said. He comes around sometimes. He and Arthur get along surprisingly well.
And the dogs?
He likes dogs, said Ty. One of the chihuahuas had fallen asleep by the front door, all four paws in the air. That dog looks dead.
It isn't dead, it's relaxing.
Ty seemed amused.
Julian ruffled his brother's hair.
Ty leaned into it, cat-like. Where are Emma and Christina?
They went to bring the car around, said Ty, and Livy went back to her room.
Why can't I come with you?
Too many of us will look suspicious, Julian said. You'll have to stay here, guard the Institute.
Ty looked unconvinced. He frowned after them as Mark and Julian hurried out the front doors.
The car was pulled up in front of the Institute, the engine idling.
Emma pushed the passenger side door open and whistled.
Mark, you look amazing.
Mark glanced down at himself, surprised. A surge of prickly heat ran up the insides of Julian's wrists. Christina was in the back seat, also looking at Mark. Julian couldn't read her expression. Emma patted the seat beside her. In the dimness of the car, she was a shadow. White dress, golden hair, like a faded illustration in a children's picture book.
Hop in, Jules. You're mine, my navigator.
You're mine. He slid into the seat beside hers.
Right turn here, Julian said, pointing.
You'd think the Institute could afford to have reliable GPS installed in this stupid car, Emma muttered, slewing the wheel to the right. She tried to program it when they'd gotten into the Toyota, but it had refused to turn on. Once the GPS had only spoken in a heavy German accent for weeks, Julian had decided it was possessed. Christina squeaked and subsided. Emma could see her in the rearview mirror. She was subtly leaning away from Mark. It wasn't anything that someone who didn't know her well could have spotted. Mark didn't seem to have noticed. He was staring out his open window, blonde hair ruffled, humming tunelessly.
Slow down, speed racer, Julian said as someone behind Emma honked.
We're late, she said. The show was supposed to start in 10 minutes. Some people hadn't decided that semi-formal meant semi-naked.
Why are you calling me some people? Mark inquired. I'm only one person.
This is weird, Julian observed, turning back to look straight ahead. There's nobody around on this street.
There are houses, Christina pointed out.
They're all dark.
Julian's gaze scanned the road.
A little early, don't you think, for everyone to have gone to bed?
He pointed.
There's the theater.
He was right. Emma could see lights, hot neon and electricity up ahead. The arrow shape of a sign, the Midnight Theater.
The Hollywood Hills glittered in the distance as if they'd been dusted with starlight. Everything else was dark, even the streetlights. As they neared the theater, the sides of the street became more thickly packed with parked cars. Expensive ones. BMWs, Porsches, Italian sports cars whose names Emma couldn't remember. She pulled into a spot across from the theater and killed the engine.
Are we ready?
She swung around to look into the back seat. Christina winked at her. Mark nodded.
Then let's go.
Julian was already out of the car, opening the trunk. He rummaged through the weapons and steelies, reaching out to Christina with a pair of slim-throwing knives.
Need these?
Christina slipped the strap of her dress aside. Clipped to her bra was one of her butterfly knives, the etched rose gleaming on the handle. I came prepared.
I didn't.
Mark reached out to take the two sheathed knives and unbutton his jacket to slide them into his belt. He reached up to his throat, touching the arrowhead that hung around his neck. Arrested, Julian watched him. His blue-green eyes were dark, uncertain. Emma could read the look on his face. He didn't know if his brother was ready to go into potential danger. Didn't like it. Didn't see another way.
Okay, Julian said. Weapons hidden. Any runes you want to put on now, put them in places no one will see them.
Permanent runes. Check to make sure they're covered up. We can't risk running into a situation where we'll be recognized by anyone with the sight.
Emma nodded.
They'd already put concealing makeup on her voyance and parabatai runes back at the Institute. She'd even done what she could to cover up the small scars that showed where runes had been and then vanished. Some runes were permanent and some temporary. Voyance, which looked like an open eye and helped you see through glamours, was permanent. So were wedding and parabatai runes. Temporary runes disappeared slowly as they were used up. Healing Yahrzeis, for instance, vanished with varying speed, depending on the seriousness of the wound. A sure-footedness rune might last the duration of a climb up a mountain. To get the absolute best results, when going into battle, a rune ought to be as new as possible. Jules rolled his sleeve up and held his arm out to Emma.
The honors, he said.
She took a steely from the trunk and ran it over his bare forearm. Sure strike, swiftness, and courage. When she was done, she lifted her hair and turned, offering her bare back to Julian.
If you put the runes between my shoulder blades, my hair should cover them, she said.
Julian didn't say anything. She felt him hesitate, and then the lightest touch of his hand on her back, steadying her. He was breathing quickly. Nerves, she thought. It was a strange situation they were walking into, and he was worried for Mark. He started on the second rune, and Emma felt a slight biting sting as the steely moved. She frowned. Usually, though runes could sting or burn when applied, runes placed on you by your parabatai didn't hurt. In fact, they were almost pleasant. It was like being wrapped in the protection of friendship, the sense that someone else had sealed their dedication to you onto your skin. Strange for it to hurt. Julian finished, stepping back, and Emma let her hair fall. She turned and drew a quick agility rune on Christina's shoulder under the strap of her dress. Then she looked at Mark. He shook his head, just as he had every time a rune had been offered to him before.
No runes, he said tightly.
It's fine, Julian said before anyone else could speak. He doesn't have marks on him, besides the voyance, and that's covered in makeup. He looks normal.
Normal-ish, said Emma, his ears and his eyes.
Christina stepped forward and reached up to muss Mark's hair, spilling the curls down to cover his pointed ears. There's nothing we can do about the eyes, but...
Mundanes have heterochromia, too, said Jules. The main thing is, Mark, try to act normal.
Mark looked affronted.
Do I ever not?
No one answered that, not even Christina. After sliding a pair of daggers into the shoulder harness under his shirt, Julian slammed the trunk closed, and they headed across the street. The doors of the theater were thrown open. Light spilled out onto the dark pavement. Emma could hear laughter and music, smell the mingled scents of perfume and wine and smoke. At the door, a young woman in a slinky red dress was taking tickets and stamping hands. Her hair was done up in 4D-style victory roll curls, and her lips were blood red. She wore ivory satin gloves that reached her elbows.
Emma recognized her immediately. She'd seen her at the Shadow Market, winking at Johnny Rook.
I've seen her before, she whispered to Jules. Shadow Market.
He nodded and tucked his hand around Emma's. She jolted slightly.
both of the sudden heat around her palm and in surprise. She glanced over at him, saw the look on his face as he smiled at the familiar-looking ticket girl. A little bored, a little arrogant, a lot entitled. Someone who wasn't worried about getting inside at all. He was playing a role, and taking her hand was part of it. And that was all there was to it. He held out their ticket. "Mr. Smith, plus 3 guests," he said. There was a slight commotion behind them as Mark opened his mouth, doubtless to ask who Mr. Smith was, and Christina stomped on his foot. The ticket girl smiled, her red lips curving up into a bow, and slowly tore the ticket in half. If she recognized Emma, she didn't show it. "Mr. Smith," she said, "hold out your hand." Julian offered his free hand, and the ticket girl stamped it with red-black ink. The stamp was an odd little symbol, lines of water underneath a flame. "The performance is running a bit late tonight. You'll find your row and seat numbers have appeared on your ticket. Please don't sit in anyone else's seat." Her gaze went to Mark, a sharp, intent, assessing gaze. "And welcome," she said. "I believe you will find the followers a sympathetic group." Mark looked baffled. Hands stamped and ticket torn, the four of them trailed into the theater. The moment they crossed the threshold, the music rose to deafening levels, and Emma recognized it as the kind of big band jazz ensemble her father had loved. "Just because I play the violin doesn't mean I don't like dancing," she remembered him saying, swinging her mother into an impromptu foxtrot in the kitchen. Julian turned to her. "What is it?" he asked gently. Emma wished he couldn't read her moods quite so perfectly. She glanced away to hide her expression. Mark and Christina were behind them, looking around. There was a concession stand selling popcorn and candy. A sign reading, "Dance Hall Theater," hung over the stand, pointing left. People in fancy dress were moving excitedly down the hallway. "Nothing. We should go that way," Emma said, and tugged on Julian's hand. "Follow the crowd." "Hell of a crowd," he muttered. He wasn't wrong. Emma didn't think she'd seen so many expensively dressed people in one place before. It's like walking into a noir film. Everywhere were beautiful people. The kind of Hollywood beautiful Emma was used to seeing around Los Angeles. People who had access to gyms and tanning salons and expensive hairdressers and the best clothes. Here, they looked as if they dressed as extras for a Rat Pack movie. Silk dresses and seamed stockings, fedoras and skinny ties, and peaked lapels. Apparently, Julian's Psy divorce suit had been a presciently smart choice. The room was elegant, with a pressed copper ceiling, arched windows, and closed doors marked theater left and theater right. A rug had been rolled back for dancing, and couples were swirling together to the sound of a band playing on a raised stage at the end of the room. Thanks to her father's tutelage, she recognized trombones and trumpets, drums, an upright bass, and no special knowledge needed there, a piano. There was a clarinet player, too, who took his lips away from the instrument long enough to grin at Emma as she came into the room. He had auburn curls, and there was something odd about his eyes. "He's very," Mark said, his voice suddenly tight. "At least in part." "Oh." Emma shot a second look around the room, gaze sweeping over the dancers. She dismissed them as mundanes, but glancing through the crowd, she saw a pointed ear there, a flash of orange eyes or talent fingernails here. "WHATISIT?" Jules wrote on her back, his fingertips warm through the thin material of her dress. "They're all something," Emma said. She remembered the sign at the shadow market. "Part supernatural, you're not alone." "Good thing we covered our runes. They've all got the sight. They've all got some kind of magic." "The musicians are half-gentry fair folk," said Mark. "Which is not surprising, for there is nothing the shining ones value more than music. But there are others here whose blood is mixed with those of merfolk, and some who are wares." "Come on, newbies," the auburn-haired clarinetist shouted, and a sudden spotlight shone down on the shadow hunters. "Get into the swing of things." When Emma looked at him blankly, he wiggled his eyebrows, and she realized what was strange about his eyes. They were like a goat's, with square black pupils. "Dance," he shouted, and the others in the room whooped and clapped. The glare of the moving spotlight rendered Julian's face a white blur as he reached for Christina and pulled her into the crowd. Emma's heart gave a slow, heavy thump. She pushed the feeling down, turned to Mark, and held her hands out to him. "Dance?" "I don't know how."
There was something in his expression, half puzzlement and half anxiety, that sent a twinge of sympathy through Emma's heart. He took her hands uncertainly.
Fairy dances are not like this.
Emma drew him toward the crowd. His fingers in hers were slim and cold, not like Jules's warm clasp.
It's all right, I'll lead.
They moved in among the dancers. Emma led, trying to remember what she'd seen in movies where there was dancing like this. Despite her promise to lead, she wondered if she'd be better off leaving Mark in charge. He had incredible grace. While all her years of fight training made her want to lunge and spin kick more than twirl and shuffle. Emma glanced over at a girl with short, bright green hair.
"Can you tell what everyone is?" she asked Mark.
He blinked, his pale lashes scattering light.
"She's part dryad," he said. "Wood fairy. Probably not as much as half. Fairy blood can show up generations later. Most humans who have the sight have fairy blood years back."
"What about the musicians?"
Mark swung Emma in a turn. He'd started to lead instinctively. There was something forlorn about the music, Emma thought, as if it were drifting down from a high, distant place. "The clarinetist is part satyr. The bassist with the pale blue skin? Some kind of merfolk. Kieran's mother was a Nixie, a water fairy, and..." He broke off. Emma could see Jules and Christina, her hot pink dress startling against the black of his suit. He twirled her. Emma bit the inside of her lip.
"Kieran? That gentry prince who came with you to the Institute?"
Mark was sharp-boned light and shadows in the moving illumination. The air smelled like incense, like the cheap sweet stuff they burned on the Venice boardwalks.
"We were friends in the Wild Hunt."
"Well, he could have been less of a jerk to you then," Emma muttered.
"I don't think he could have, actually."
Mark smiled, and Emma could see where the human in him mixed with the fae. Fairies, in her experience, never smiled with such openness. She made a face. "Was there anything about the hunt that wasn't awful? Was any of it, I don't know, fun?"
"Parts."
He laughed and spun her. There was that edge of fae again, the wildness of it. She paced back, slowing the dance.
"What parts?"
He whirled her in a circle.
"I'm not supposed to talk about it. It's a gesh."
Emma exhaled. "Like, if you told me, then you'd have to kill me?"
"Why would I kill you?"
Mark sounded honestly bewildered. She tipped her head back and smiled at him. Sometimes talking to him was like talking to Ty, she thought. She found herself making jokes she thought were obvious and then realizing they weren't obvious at all unless you understood the subtle codes of social interaction. She didn't know how she'd learned them, just that she had, and Ty still struggled with them, and so, it seemed, did Mark. Trying to look at the world through Ty's eyes, Julian had said once, was like looking into a kaleidoscope, shaking it up, and then looking again. You saw all the same glimmering crystals, just in a different formation.
"The Wild Hunt was freedom," Mark said, "and freedom is necessary."
In Mark's eyes, Emma could see a wilderness of stars and treetops, the fierce shine of glaciers, all the glittering detritus of the roof of the world. It made her think of riding that motorcycle over the ocean, of the freedom to be wild and untrammeled, of the ache she felt in her soul sometimes, to be connected to nothing, answerable to nothing, bound by nothing.
"Mark," she began.
Mark's expression changed. He was looking past her suddenly, his hand tightening on hers. Emma glanced where he was looking but saw only the cloakroom. A bored-looking coat check girl perched on the counter, smoking a cigarette out of a silver holder.
"Mark?"
Emma turned back to him, but he was already moving away from her, vaulting over the counter of the coat check station, much to the bored girl's amusement, and vanishing. Emma was about to follow him when Christina and Julian swung into her line of sight, blocking her.
"Mark ran off," Emma announced.
"Yeah, he's not exactly a team player yet," said Julian. He was ruffled from dancing, his cheeks flushed. Christina didn't have a hair out of place.
"Look, I'll go after him, and you two dance."
"If I might cut in."
A tall young man appeared in front of them. He looked like he was probably about 25, nattily dressed in a herringbone suit and matching fedora. His hair was bleached blonde, and he wore expensive-looking shoes with red soles that flashed fire as he walked. A gaudy pink cocktail ring glittered on his middle finger. His gaze was fixed on Christina.
"Would you like to dance?"
"If you don't mind," Julian said, his voice easy, polite, reaching to put a hand on Christina's arm. "My girlfriend and I were..." The man's friendly expression changed, infinitesimally, but Emma could see it. A tautness behind his eyes that made Julian's words trail off.
"And if you don't mind," he said, I think you may have failed to notice I'm a blue. He tapped his pocket, where an invitation that matched the one they'd found in Ava's purse was folded. Matched it, except for being a pale shade of blue. He rolled his eyes at their puzzled expressions.
Newbies, he muttered,
and there was an undercurrent of something unpleasant, almost scornful in his dark eyes.
Of course.
Christina shot a quick look at Julian and Emma, and then turned back to the stranger with a smile. We're so sorry to have misunderstood. Julian's face was grim as Christina headed onto the dance floor with the man who'd called himself a blue. Emma sympathized. She comforted herself with the knowledge that if he tried anything on the dance floor, Christina would fillet him with her butterfly knife.
We'd better dance, too, said Julian. Looks like it's the only way not to be noticed.
We've already been noticed, Emma thought.
It was true. Though no fuss had been made over their arrival, plenty of people in the crowd were casting them sideways glances. There were quite a few of the followers who looked entirely human, and indeed, Emma wasn't totally clear on their policy regarding mundanes, but as newcomers, she imagined they were still objects of attention. Certainly the behavior of the clarinetist had indicated as much. She took Julian's hand and they moved into the outside of the crowd, toward the end of the room, where the shadows were deeper.
Half-fairies, ifrits, wares, Emma murmured, taking Julian's other hand so that they faced each other. He looked more ruffled than he had before, his cheeks flushed. She couldn't blame him for being unsettled. In most crowds, their runes, if discovered, would mean nothing. But she had the feeling this crowd was different.
Why are they all here?
It isn't easy having the sight, if you don't know others who do, Julian said in a low voice. You see things nobody else sees. You can't talk about it because no one will understand. You have to keep secrets, and secrets, they break you apart, cut you open, make you vulnerable. The low timbre of his voice shuddered down through Emma's bones. There was something in it that frightened her, something that reminded her of the glaciers in Mark's eyes, distant and lonely.
Jules, she said.
Muttering something like, never mind, he spun her away, then pulled her back toward him. Years of practicing fighting together made them an almost perfect dancing team, she realized with surprise. They could predict each other's movements, glide with each other's bodies. She could tell which way Julian would step by the cadence of his breath and the faint tightening of his fingers around hers. Julian's dark curls were wildly tousled, and when he drew her near him, she could smell the clove spice of his cologne, the faint scent of paint underneath. The song ended. Emma looked up and over at the band. The clarinetist was watching her and Julian. Unexpectedly, he winked. The band struck up again, this time a slower, softer number. Couples moved together as if magnetized, arms wrapping around necks, hands resting on hips, heads leaning together. Julian had frozen. Emma had her hands still in his, stood stock still, not moving, not breathing. The moment stretched out, interminable. Julian's eyes searched hers. Whatever he saw there seemed to decide him. His arms came up around her, and he pulled her close. Her chin hit his shoulder awkwardly. It was the first awkward thing they'd done together. She felt him inhale, a hitching breath against her. His hands splayed warm under her shoulder blades. She turned her head. She could hear his heartbeat, swift and furious under her ear, feel the hardness of his chest. She reached up to loop her arms around his neck. There was enough of a height difference between them that when she locked her fingers, they tangled in the hair of his nape. A shiver went through her. She touched Julian's hair before, of course, but it was so soft there, there at the vulnerable space just under the fall of loose curls. And the skin was soft, too. She stroked downward with her fingers reflexively and felt at the same time the top bump of his spine and his swiftly inhaled breath. She looked up at him. His face was white, eyes cast down, dark lashes feathered against his cheekbones. He was biting his bottom lip, the way he always did when he was nervous. She could see the dents his teeth made in the soft skin. If she kissed him, would he taste like blood or cloves or a mixture of the two? Sweet and spicy? Bitter and hot? She made herself shove the thought down. He was her parabatai. He wasn't for kissing. He was... His left hand moved down over her back to her waist, sliding around to lightly cup her hip. Her body jolted. She'd heard of people having butterflies in their stomachs, and she knew what they meant, that flapping, uneasy feeling deep in your gut. But she had it now, everywhere. Butterflies under all of her skin, fluttering, sending shivers that moved in waves up and down her body.
she began to trace her finger over his wrist, meaning to write on him. J-U-L-I-A-N-W-H-A-T